And this is KPCW. Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta on this Friday, June 7th. On the phone with me, I've got Nate Larson, meteorologist with ABC4. How's it going, Nate?
Hey, Parker. Hey, Park City. Yeah, hey, Bert. We've got somewhat active skies already this morning. We had a thunderstorm roll through areas of the Wasatch back. But overall, partly cloudy conditions expected for today with another chance of increased moisture into the afternoon. So some of those spring thunderstorms, almost like a monsoon feel as moisture streams in from the southwest. So the overall setup, still high pressure to the southeast of us. Because the ridge has slid further southeast into Colorado, it has opened up this door for limited moisture to move through. Plan on high of 82 today, overnight lows near 54 into Saturday. Hebrew will see 89 today. Also seeing a risk of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm. On Saturday, less of a threat of moisture. Temperatures around 80 degrees in Park City, 87 in Heber. And then into Sunday and Monday, we'll continue to see limited moisture move into the area, so it'll generate that slight chance of an afternoon shower or storm. So not going to be a washout of a weekend into early next week. By any means, just keep your eye to the sky, as we do have that risk with some moisture in place of some of these storms flaring up into the afternoon. So in Park City, plan on a high of 81 on Sunday, dropping to 76 on Monday with that threat of moisture. Rebounding back to upper 70s on Tuesday with mostly sunny skies. Wednesday should top out again near 82, and Thursday a high of 80. In Heber, plan on partly cloudy to mostly sunny skies throughout the weekend as well. That small threat of moisture remains. We'll see temperatures in the upper 80s over the weekend, dropping into the mid-80s early next week. That mid-80 relief, I guess, from some of the well above average temperatures is short-lived. We should be right near 90 degrees again towards the middle of next week. And high pressure looks like it's going to stick around for much of next week into next weekend. Parker?
All right. Thanks a lot, Nate. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Coming up, we'll have three guests this hour. First, we'll have Park City resident Melissa Chanel. She'll discuss her experience playing in the inaugural season of the Professional Women's Hockey League. Then Park City Councilmember Tana Tolley will recap city council meetings over the past 2 days, which included a lot of discussion about the Bonanza Park 5 acres. We'll end the hour with athletic trainer Robin Hayes and physical therapist Marlene Hatch with Intermountain Park City Hospital. They'll have details about an upcoming speaker series about injury prevention. Then stay tuned for Fresh Tracks Friday, which starts after the local news hour at 9. Let's get into some local news. The Park City School District and parents held its second panel discussion in 2 months on cell phone use in schools. KPCW's Christine Weller reports many don't want phones in schools at all.
Parents and district employees met at Ecker Hill Middle School Wednesday to continue the conversation on the effect cell phones can have on youth mental health. Katie Wright is one of the parents who helped organize the meeting. She said discussions about youth mental health have been going on for a while, but she didn't realize how big of a problem it was for a long time.
And then I had that horrible wake-up call, and like so many in the community, realized how big of an issue this is, that we as adults need to make sure that we are creating and co-creating a world that our kids want to live in and that they thrive in.
Wednesday's meeting was just the start of that effort. Panelist Pamela Bello, Director of Behavioral Health Prevention for Summit County, shared data from the Utah Student Health and Risk Prevention Survey. The survey is conducted every other year in grades 6, 8, 10, and 12. The data show in the past 12 months, more than 50% of Summit County students who used their phone 5 or more hours a day had felt sad or hopeless almost every day for 2 weeks. That's compared to over 20% of students who use their phone for 4 hours per day. Bello said the data show kids' mental health and cell phone usage is related. Treasure Mountain Junior High Principal Caleb Fine agreed cell phones impact youth mental health. He said phones are the source of a lot of harassment in schools, especially Snapchat, the messaging app allowing users to exchange pictures and videos that disappear after being viewed.
Snapchat's my version of the devil. I've not yet seen anything positive happen in that mode of communication because the kids feel like it's going away. Some of the worst anti-Semitic things we dealt with and our students have been exposed to happened on Snapchat.
Fine said some Treasure Mountain students have sent nude pictures to each other via Snapchat, which then required the administration to involve police. He said he's aware of an uptick in students experiencing suicidal ideation, which he said could be related to social media. Jill Thompson, a second grade teacher at McPolin and a parent, shared a personal experience about bullying on social media platforms. Her youngest daughter got a cell phone at age 12, and that's when bullying and harassment started.
She posted a picture of her riding her horse. At 12 years old, her very first post, and some boys at school were sending very inappropriate messages. And from that point forward, she was very sexualized anytime she posted anything.
Thompson said the harassment led to her daughter getting an eating disorder, which she spent 6 weeks in the hospital for. She said part of the problem is many people use social media as a mask.
I knew some of these kids, and I know they would not say these things to her in person. And very easy for them to hide behind a screen.
Jaden Ackerman, the Park City High School president of an anti-bullying and suicide prevention club called Hope Squad, said she also was the victim of online bullying. The bullying went on for months, and Ackerman said she reported it at the end of the school year because she didn't want it to follow her through the year.
In the end, this was happening to other kids who didn't have the strength to report it that I did, and they all came forward once I came forward.
There wasn't a clear solution to help kids negatively impacted by cell phones and social media identified on Wednesday. While having a no cell phone policy in school might help kids stay focused, it wouldn't solve online bullying outside of school hours. Further, some kids use cell phones to aid learning, like students whose first language isn't English. Most panel members agreed it would be best to wait to give kids smartphones until they're 16 and to not allow phones in kids' bedrooms at night. However, if students do have cell phones, Ackerman recommended setting screen limits and ensuring parents know what their kids are looking at. And whether a child has a cell phone or not, panelists also agreed students should be encouraged to report bullying and harassment. Students can make reports online with the Park City School District's new standardized system. Holland Lincoln, a parent who also helped organize the panel, said parents should start by having conversations with their kids about technology and social media.
We need to start having these conversations all the time to explain to our kids how they fit into this ecosystem and that they're becoming products when they're using these tools, and give them some agency.
Then, she said, it's time for community conversations and finally policy changes in schools and local government. Parents and the district plan to continue discussions surrounding cell phone use. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, in studio with me now, I've got Melissa Channel. She's a Park City resident and a professional hockey league player. Melissa, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me. Nice to be back.
Yeah. So you participated. You're a player for Minnesota's team in the inaugural season of the Professional Women's Hockey League. Before you get into that, though, I guess just give us some background. You've lived in Park City for a couple years now. Tell us about yourself.
Yeah. So I moved to Park City around 2021. One of my old teammates actually introduced me to my now fiance. We're getting married in 2 weeks.
Congrats.
So planning a wedding and playing hockey was a little tough, but so I moved out here 2021 and have called Park City home for then, and it's just been no place I'd rather be, honestly.
Yeah, good hockey scene?
In Minnesota or here?
Well, here, I guess, to start.
The hockey's different, for sure.
Yeah.
I think with the NHL coming in, it'll definitely skyrocket, but I used to just play in local beer league games just to kind of stay in shape, and would go to stick and puck sometimes with some of the guys just to work on some skills. But it was definitely a lot different than what most of the girls were doing, where they all live in the same area and train together every day. But being a part of the league and being able to live in the market was very beneficial.
Yeah, and so kind of walk me through your hockey career, starting from a young age and kind of how you progress.
So I started when I think I was 3 years old. So my dad is a scout in the NHL.
Cool.
So it was bound that one of his kids were going to play hockey, and then my sister was a dancer, so then it was me. They took me to an open skate, and they opened the door, put skates on, closed the door, and I was screaming. Like, I did not want any part of it. Long story short, I grew up in Detroit.
Okay.
Played in Michigan for a while, then moved to Canada, played in Canada for a bit, went to the University of Wisconsin, played 4 years there. And then I played in, it was called the CWHL. I played 1 year there, league folded, and then they started up the PWHPA, which was basically like a players association. So we kind of operated like the PLL. So we would fly into different places and play tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, this past season, we were grateful enough that we had unbelievable support with the Walter Group and Billie Jean King to generate this league for us. So now we have a professional league.
Yeah, and kind of how did this come together? How did you kind of first learn about it? And
so I've been a part of, it was the PWHPA at first.
Okay, so it transformed.
So that's kind of Kendall Coyne Schofield. She's kind of well-known in the hockey world, but she called up Billie Jean King when, after the CWHL folded, and was like, we need to figure something out. We have too many good female athletes who are cutting their career short because they don't have anywhere to play post-college. So it took 5 hard years of grinding, putting things together, but we were able to get it accomplished. It was super quick. Within, once we got the 2 groups together, and then now we have a league for young girls to dream about playing in.
Yeah, and I think, is it 6 teams, 8 teams?
6 teams. Teams. So 3 Canadian, 3 American.
Yeah, very strategically placed in great hockey locations. I assume, where are you at in Minnesota? Do you all play?
We're in St. Paul, so we actually play where the Minnesota Wild play.
Very cool.
Our practice rink is their practice rink, and vice versa.
And how's the fan support, I assume?
It's good.
For a state like Minnesota.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, Minnesota is known as the state of hockey. Right. And we have a bunch of local Minnesota girls on the team, which helps. So girls who played at University of Minnesota. So we get fans from there, youth hockey teams. Like, it's actually, I remember when we came out for our first game, it was signs lined up along the glass. And you were like, oh my gosh, like, this is real. Like, you got goosebumps. And then now to see the continual support. And I mean, not just in Minnesota, but in Montreal, they had 21,000 people at a game. In Toronto, they had 20,000. So it's crazy to see how well we're doing, and we're just so fresh.
Yeah, is there any plans for expansion, or just what's kind of the mindset going forward for the league right now?
I think there will be expansion. I don't want to say yes or
for
no.
Sure.
Just not in the next couple of years, because our league was a shortened league. So we had training camp starting in November and then played January to a couple weekends ago. So I think they want to get a couple years under the belt, see how things go, see how things progress, and then think about expansion. But as of right now, it's just going to stay the 6 for a little bit.
Yeah, and it's full regular season and playoff?
Yeah.
Is that the setup?
Yeah, well, so this first season was shortened. I think we only played like 23, 24 games. But I think the following seasons will be a full year, and then the top 2 or top 4 teams make playoffs. So the bottom 2...
Gotcha. Yeah, and I read online, correct me if I'm wrong, but I read that the league differs from previous women's leagues in its decision to include body checking as permissible. So and you're on the defensive side, correct?
Yeah.
So can you kind of talk a bit about this and how that's made it different?
It's definitely made a big change in the game. Being a smaller defenseman, mm-hmm. you kind of get a little nervous, but once you get a couple hits under your belt, you're fine. But it's not so much open ice hits. So it's more so along the boards, which honestly I think kind of benefits us in a sense. I think in the women's game they did do it, but it wasn't as hard and they would get called. But now it's kind of just you can do it. And I think the first couple games people are a little nervous because they're like, oh my gosh, if I hit you, I don't want to get a penalty. But then once everyone started getting more comfortable, the game started to get a lot better, in my opinion.
Yeah. You know, I think it's people well aware that women professional athletes are paid, you know, consistently less than men. Is this a league that is allowing the players, I mean, do they have to get other jobs, or is this financially supporting them?
It's financially supporting. I mean, it's a shortened season, so people are getting jobs in the off season.
For sure.
But during the year, we're just there to focus on hockey, and I think that's the main difference between the first year I played in the CWHL. Like, we had girls teaching, we had girls going to 9 to 5 and then coming to practice and then having to do it all over again. Like, you don't see that anymore, which I think is huge for us. Like, we can actually focus directly on our sport and just getting better at our sport. But then in the off season, you know, some people will find like the odd job. A lot of people do hockey camps, but you don't need a 9 to 5 during the year.
Yeah, and you know, you kind of spoke about the just void of playing opportunities when that previous league folded. After college, would normally the only opportunity to play be like the Olympics or?
So there was another league. It's called the PHF, the Professional Hockey Federation. So they folded when the PWHL came in. So there was two American leagues. There was the CWHL and the PHF. Once the CWHL folded, we created the PWHPA. Mm-hmm. So there was two kind of opposite ones. But a lot of girls will go overseas to Europe. If you're fortunate enough, you can do the Olympic team with the national team and all that stuff. But for the most part, it was just college and then you were done. So I think it's huge that I know I coached girls back in Detroit for a 16 and 19 U team. And now they're like, oh my gosh, like we can actually play hockey after college. Like we don't, this isn't our end all. And so it's kind of cool to see that they actually have something to strive for post college.
Yeah. And just the state of hockey, whether it is Utah or Minnesota, do you feel like the sport is growing? Do you see more youth participation?
I think so. I think I saw something on USA Hockey that 100,000 registered players this year. I could, don't quote me on that. I could be wrong, but it's definitely growing. I think especially in the state of Michigan, it's always been big. The state of Minnesota, it's always been big, but I think it's kind of growing in areas like Utah, and I think it'll grow once the NHL is set here. And I think out west it's starting to get a little bit bigger too. So I think just being able, and I think now that we have the opportunity to play, more people might, fingers crossed. But I think it's huge that there's definitely different avenues that people can take and have more chances to continue on playing.
We've been sitting here and I haven't even brought up the most exciting piece, which is that your team, Minnesota, won the championship for this inaugural season of the league. You've got the hat on. Walk me through the season and just kind of how it ended.
Yeah, so the season started off really well. I think we were on like a 5-game win streak. It's honestly kind of tough with a 6-league team because you play the same teams over and over again, but it kind of helps because you learn their tendencies, so you know how each team's going to play. But we went through a little bit of a skid near the end of the year. I think a lot of people counted us out, especially I think we had 5 games to get 1 point.
Oh, wow.
To clinch a playoff. We did not do that. But it all came down to Toronto beating Ottawa in the final game of the season. And Toronto did that. So a couple of the girls were at my house watching it, and we were trying not to get too excited when things happened. But once they won, we were like, oh my gosh, okay, we get to play in playoffs. Here we go. And then we do a new thing where it's the number one seed gets to pick who they play. So they get to pick between 3 and 4.
Interesting.
So we were 4. Toronto was 1, and Toronto picked us. And then we were like, okay, it's go time. Excuse me. And then we went down 0-2. We went to Toronto. We played there. I think they had 9,000 people at their games. It's kind of intimidating. Toronto fans are, if you know anything about Toronto fans, they're intense. But we went down 0-2, and our coach just came in, and he's like, you guys, it's just one game. Like, all you have to do is win one game. And we're like, you know what? Yeah, like, it's just, they picked us. Like, let's prove them wrong. So we won game 3. And then game 4, I think, was the double overtime game where it was like, it was crazy.
Is that sudden death, too, like with the NHL?
Yeah, so it was exhausting. And they're 20-minute periods, and it's it was exhausting. But then we won that game, and then we got back to Toronto for Game 5, and our coach was like, guys, message doesn't change. One game, and you make it to the finals. So when we made it to the finals, it was kind of a surreal moment. I get goosebumps thinking about it. But then we go to Boston, and they came out hot. They just beat Montreal, and Montreal is a pretty star-studded team, if you look at it. So they were on a high, and, you know, that series was just back and forth, back and forth. We thought we won it in Game 4 in double overtime. Goal got called back. So then we had to go to Game 5, and then our team was just like, this is our time. And we, I don't want to say we dominated, but we did. So I think, and then once Kendall Coyne scored the empty net goal with like 2 minutes left, all of us were
sealed it,
kind of going crazy on the bench. Rewatching the videos of us celebrating just kind of brings back memories, and it gives you goosebumps. But it was a good time. It was definitely a season to remember, especially apart with all the girls. It'll be something that we'll never forget.
Yeah, hard to beat for a first season. So does the league, we have a draft for new players?
Yep, so the draft is on the 10th.
Okay.
So in a couple days. I think it's a 6-round, 7-round. And then free agency signings until June 21st. And then I don't think camp starts until maybe November, October-ish.
And then what's the season timeline?
I'm not sure yet.
Okay. And is there a way for people to watch if they are interested?
Yeah. I think all games actually are recorded on YouTube.
YouTube, yeah.
If you just look up PWHL, all the games from all season will be on there. And then I think there's Bali Sports, but I don't think that's this direction.
Yeah, it'd be more local.
TSN for people in Canada, but most people here watch it on the YouTube, so.
Yeah, well, Melissa, I appreciate you coming in and sharing the experience. Is there anything else you want to mention?
Not that I can think of, no.
Well, appreciate your time, and I know people can see you, you're at Minorstown Gym as an athletic trainer.
My fiance coaches. I used to coach before I left. I might get back into it, but we have a wedding in 2 weeks, so it's a little bit, I'm a little busy with that aspect, but I still make my way in there to work out. Off season started, but there's no true off season in a sense.
Yeah, well, congrats on the wedding and the championship.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, have a good one.
You too.
We've been speaking with Melissa Channel. She's a professional hockey league player for Minnesota. They just won the championship in the inaugural season. Record snowfall in 2023 resulted in a flooding emergency in the spring. KPCW's Grace Storfler reports Wasatch County will use federal funds to repair roads damaged in the floods.
President Joe Biden announced in December that five Utah counties, including Wasatch County, are eligible for federal disaster relief funds following the flooding. Governor Spencer Cox declared a state of emergency due to flooding caused by snow runoff in April 2023. A few Wasatch County roads were hit especially hard, including Snake Creek Road, Little Pole Road, Big Pole Road, Little Valley Road, and Pine Canyon Road near Guardsman Pass. At a county council meeting June 5th, Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh said the damage is significant, especially on Snake Creek Road. The repairs may take 2 or more years, and most of the cost will be paid by the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
75% of the cost will be covered by the FEMA grant.
I mean, we're talking millions of dollars.
Yes, it's going to be a multi-million dollar project.
The county will allocate approximately $684,000 to the repairs. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
In studio with me now is Park City Council member Tana Tolley. How's it going, Tana?
It's going great, Parker. How are you?
I'm great. You're fresh off of back-to-back meetings. A lot of discussion about Bonanza Park. I'd figure we'd start there. On the 5 acres.
Great. Yeah, I don't know if I'm fresh off of it because it's been a long 2 days, but I'm feeling pretty good. We had a long meeting on Wednesday that just centered around what are we going to do with a 5-acre site in the Bonanza Park District. And we had our team of consultants come in. We sat in the back of the room. We did this in more of a work session format where they gave us 6 questions that really need to be answered by the council in order for them to move forward with a RFP later this summer, which is a request for proposals. So those were housing affordability, how we want to structure parking, commercial use, Kimball Art Center, city financial support, and then city ownership. And the council answered each of these questions, and in the end, they are going. We decided to have them come back in late June, and they're going to give us about 3 to 6 different scenarios on how we can fund this, what we can move forward with, where the gap funding will be, and really give us something to move forward with where we can sink our teeth into.
Yeah, and just to dive into a couple of those, like for instance, I know specifics still need to be kind of detailed out, but you know, the council seemed to be supportive of giving the Kimball Art Center some space on that site.
Yeah, absolutely. Art and culture is very important to this council and to this community, and our partnership with Kimball is a key part of that, as well as other art organizations in town. But with Kimball, we are going to continue negotiations that are being worked on with them. We've given ourselves also a deadline for when we would like to have those negotiations completed. But some of the parameters that are going to be important for a developer going forward are the size of the parcel, the location, access to parking and connectivity, and the scale. So we had some different conversations about what gives the developer more flexibility, what will Kimball be able to do in terms of how they want to create the space. And So we did definitely say we want to have a commitment to that, and we're going to continue negotiations, and we're moving forward quickly with that as well.
Yeah, and then also some separate maker spaces. I thought that was
Yeah, I love the makerspace concept, and I brought it up. We were just on city tour in Durango, Ridgeway, and Telluride, and in Ridgeway they had a affordable housing space with, on the bottom floor was makerspace, which was art, like an art kind of gallery where basically there were no designs in it at all. You would just be able to go in there as an artist and completely create what you like. And those kinds of ideas, I think, spur some of what we're looking for to give the community an opportunity to showcase what they do maybe at a professional level, but also as just as a hobby. But we know there's a lot of community members in the art space who want to have a space to go and showcase what they've been working on.
Yeah, and I know, you know, several members expressed that they wanted to see just more detailed kind of financial estimates, but some interest in some underground parking there.
Absolutely. We understand that underground parking is going to be more costly than having surface grade parking. However, the trade-off there is when you have underground parking, you can put something on above it, right? Yeah. So then you can actually program that space and use it for some sort of economic development there, whether that's housing or a mixed space property. But to take an acre and maybe make another China Bridge parking was not what this council was in favor of, knowing that this is going to be costly, it's going to be expensive, and we will have to work with that in the constraints of our TRT revenue that was put towards this when they did that TRAT tax. So
yeah, and then affordable housing, another consideration as well.
Yeah, that was a big conversation. Parking, I think, took the longest, and then housing came in second. And the housing affordability is a really good question. We had a really great, robust conversation on what you can actually do in this community. I sometimes quote previous council member Max Doyleny, who said, basically, you can throw a dart at some sort of housing and you'll hit something that we need in this community. So I think we're very aware that we need all types of housing, and we really do want to support our workforce, and trying to understand what that looks like. Is that the workforce that is working in the shops on Main Street? Is that the workforce that is our entry-level worker coming into City Hall? Is it sales managers in hotels? And for me, it's all of the above. So really finding basically where we can put a pin in this is the AMI that we want to go with. Also realizing that the financing tools that most developers are using in affordable housing is called LIHTC, and it is very, very competitive, and there's a little bit more parameters around it this year. And so we also want this project to move fast. So we have some trade-offs there of what if they don't get the funding and it takes years and years for them to be able to develop affordable housing because we've gone with a lower AMI, versus what if we say maybe we are okay with a little bit of market rate and a little bit higher AMI, knowing that they can move quickly and we could be able to house more of our workforce in that space.
Yeah, and then also considering commercial space kind of throughout as well, right? That would...
Yeah, this will be there will be a mixed use, at least, you know, one building. Obviously, we're giving the developer the ability to decide how they want to do that. But we do want to have, local flair, shared spaces. We talked about never competing with Main Street. We know that Main Street is the heart and soul of our community. We also have a Main Street plan, you know, underway as well. But this would be maybe a different type of commercial there. But we're excited to see what the developer has and what the market is calling for. And then also, you know, using a little bit of maybe funding that the city has to help this project move forward.
Yeah, and I thought, just to kind of fully explain, I found it interesting. I feel like I learned a lot about RFPs in the last 2 days listening to the meeting. And essentially, the city will provide kind of these list of variables of what we all want, and then hand that to developers who will kind of come up with this creative vision.
You're right on that. And right now we actually have what's called an RSOQ out, and this is to qualify developers who are interested in working with the city. And then after those come back, then the next step is to go to this RFP where they will be we will be able to choose from hopefully some quality development partners who are have good track records and experience and creativity Our consultants reminded us that there are different types of developers that can be attracted to projects. So we definitely kind of parsed out that we're looking for something that it isn't just like a promise the moon or what they called wear you down type of developer. So we do have a little bit of work ahead of us, but I was really, really excited to see this council work extremely well together on what we want to do going forward. And we had a robust conversation, but I think we really ended up in a good place.
Yeah, and I think we've hit on all the major points. So I guess we'll turn to Bonanza Flat now.
We have so many bonanzas.
A lot of bonanzas. So the council talked about some of the trailhead management up there in Bonanza Flat. I'm sure it's starting to get, snow's not melted yet, so not too busy. But
I have confirmed that this morning, that there is still quite a bit of snow, yeah, especially towards Bloods Lake. The parking lots don't have as much snow, but if you are headed up there, please know that there's still quite a bit of snow. They think by about July 1st, we will have that underway. And I also wanted to say about trails before we jump into this, it is tick season. So please be careful when you're out there and check yourself and your animals for the next few weeks, because this is when the ticks are out.
Yeah, so trails and open space staff kind of had some recommendations for the council on ways to better manage the three trailheads, Empire, Bonanza Flat, and Bloods Lake up there. And so what was the kind of the council's determination?
Yeah, the council, we had asked in October for our Trails and Open Space team, in conjunction with Utah Open Lands and Wendy Fisher's team, to really look around the Intermountain West and other areas and see what they're doing in regards to paid parking in trailheads. There are places that are now doing reservation systems, which means you have to have a hiking permit as well as a reservation to park there. We did learn that in Big Cottonwood Canyon, or excuse me, maybe it's one of the canyons.
Yeah, Big Cottonwood,
thank you, is going to be doing some paid parking this year as well. We looked at a couple places in Colorado. But overall, we were really thrilled with the information that came back to us, but we didn't make a decision that we wanted to move forward with this summer. We asked the team to go back and really dive into the numbers of users, who's actually coming up here. I mentioned last night that we took some data from about 4 months from last summer, and 83% of people who are going up there are staying under 1 hour. So, you know, where is the need, and how could we actually do this without impacting the people who want to stay longer, and also making it easier for our residents who did purchase this property and want to use it on a daily or weekly basis, and it really is for the community. So how do we mitigate those impacts without going to some really big extremes?
Yeah, I noticed there's some strong support among some members for if there were to be a paid option in the future, excluding potentially locals from that.
Yeah, we had conversations about the hang tags that Old Town mm-hmm. residents have, perhaps some stickers. There is a little bit of concern because the cell service up there is not great.
Yeah.
So we would need to sort of figure out how are they going to be able to implement different parking plans. But they had Johnny from our parking team come in, and they're all working together. And so hopefully within the next year, we will see some creative solutions on how to mitigate the impacts up there. I think last night I also mentioned it was about 240,000 cars and people visited up there. People visited up there between a 4 month period. So that's a lot, and it's just getting busier.
And the demographic data too, from the source point from where those people are coming from, because I think it was like 25% Salt Lake City, I think 7% Park City, and then probably California.
It was 7% was Park City for sure. I can't remember the exact amount on Salt Lake. And then the other part of that was, how can we enhance and promote our transit to trails. Yeah, it's been phenomenal. I think we're now in year 3, and it's just been a great program for people to get up there without having to be in their cars.
Yeah, and Wendy Fisher, I know, mentioned that they're trying to expand that in, I believe, at the mouth of the Cottonwoods, but then she even talked about Sandy and Cottonwood Heights really trying to push down there as well.
Yeah, she's been working with their councils and trying to get people from the Wasatch Front to come up that way by using the transit to trail system. They're working on different grants in order to fund that, but I think it's great to have it coming from our side as well as from the Wasatch Front, and we're both going to combat this problem together.
Yeah, and it was clear. I wasn't aware of some of the big Cottonwood fee changes that were coming, because really a lot of those parking lots that are just kind of over the hump there from Bonanza Flat are all going to be paid. It seems like starting this summer, most of them.
Yeah, I think I wrote down here there's 10 trailheads actually in Big Cottonwood that would be affected by that. And then Timpanogos is another place where they've been charging as well. So it does seem like it's something that other areas of our community, of our state, as well as Colorado, are working on. And so we didn't want to just jump into something without doing some more research. And our Trails and Open Space team has done a phenomenal job. I will mention also that we still have our four trail rangers, and Utah Open Lands now has one staff member who's full-time that'll be a trail ranger, as well as, I think they said, three or four interns. So there's going to be quite a few people up there to help with parking mitigation and also informing people of the ecology of the area and, you know, stay away from the moose and this is for owls and that sort of thing, because it really is a conservation area as well.
Yeah. Also yesterday, some folks from the Sundance Institute were in just to kind of brief the council on the film festival this past January.
Yeah, it was great to have that team come in. We do this every year. It's part of their contract. And the theme I kept hearing was, it's so great to work with Park City and they have fun together. So I think a few of them said that. So they talked about the 40th anniversary celebration, how the operations with making Main Street two-way again and Park Avenue one-way worked really well. We had cane security at the entrances of different old town streets. And this year, just the flow of traffic was just so much easier than it had been the year before. Some of the highlights I found were they had over 17,000 submissions from over 153 countries. They did 444 screenings in Park City. 91 of those were features. They had 40 first-time filmmakers and 1.4 million engagements on social media hits. And then they talked a little bit about their economic impact, which was about $13.8 million in state and local tax revenue.
Yeah, and I think they said that was an increase as well.
They did.
The previous year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also, I wanted to ask you about the Main Street area plan. I know that was just on the agenda. What do you think people should know about that? You know, we talked about Bonanza Park, we've got Snow Park, and we've got East Village. There's all these new areas to attract visitors. You know, why is it important to think about the future of Main Street?
Absolutely. And I'm probably one of the perfect people to ask this too, Parker. I was the vice president of the from the HPCA before I became a council member. And we worked really hard on, coming up with a plan that we wanted to see what the future of Main Street would look like. And I like to say now it's a three-prong plan, which is infrastructure, it's city-owned assets on Main Street, Sweet Alley, and Marsac. And then it's what does the next, 50 years look like? And we do, as I mentioned a little bit ago, want to remain the heart and soul of the town. The city is now working really hard to move forward with this plan. We have a stakeholder group. We've asked that it goes as quickly as possible, and we learn from Bonanza, and we incorporate that into Main Street. And, you know, Main Street's been patient and waiting, and we are ready to really move this forward. And so I'm excited to see what we can come up with, not just in what did the future of Main Street look like, but also in how does it connect to other areas of town. So what does the circulation look like? What does the transit look like? And even going back to Bonanza, how does it figuratively and literally connect to Bonanza Park, the ski resorts, and how do we just make this more holistic? And really just like an overall community that isn't siloed, but all together working in the next 50 years.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention from the last 2 days?
Yeah, I mentioned it for a moment about City Tour. I just want to give a huge shout out to Miles Rademan. He has done such amazing things for this community, and the leadership program is a testament to that. And I was in class 17 when I was in my late 20s, and it was phenomenal. And this year was, it really just touched my heart being there with him on his last year of this. And I just really want to, you know, he's such a legend in this town, and I just give so much thanks and praise and gratitude towards him.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming in, Tana.
Yeah. Thank you, Parker. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks. We've been speaking with Park City Council member Tana Tolley. We'll be right back after this. Getting back to some local news, Summit County's second-ranking planner will replace retiring Community Development Director Pat Putt this August. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports on Planning, Zoning, and Design Director Peter Barnes.
Barnes takes over the county's top planning position August 1st. County Manager Shane Scott made the announcement at Wednesday's County Council meeting, comparing the succession to that of a fictional pirate ship's captain in the movie The Princess Bride.
When the Dread Pirate Roberts wanted to retire, what they would usually do is he would recruit one of his crew members to be the new Dread Pirate Roberts. And they would go down in the hole and switch masks, and then the old Dread Pirate Roberts would call the new Dread Pirate Roberts Dread Pirate Roberts.
So it is with the retirement of the community development director, he says.
We're trying to do something similar here in the county with the retirement of our Dread Pirate Roberts, a.k.a. Pat Putt.
Peter Barnes, Putt's second in command, will take up the mantle August 1st, and as community development director, he'll approve or deny permits, advise elected and appointed officials, and help applicants navigate the county's development review processes. Putt has been the community development director since March of 2013 and guided major development proposals through the county's process. That includes Dakota Pacific Real Estate's housing proposal for Kimball Junction and the Cedar Crest Village in Hoytsville, which Larry H. Miller Real Estate would develop. Both are still pending. Putt says there's, quote, no better person to lead Summit County's planning department into the next chapter. Barnes has worked at Summit County since 2013 as well. He previously owned and operated the architecture firm Peter Barnes Designs in Park City for a decade and a half. He got his start in architecture and planning in the United Kingdom, where he graduated from the University of Sheffield with a bachelor's in architecture in 1987. He didn't immediately respond to requests for comment Thursday. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In studio with me now, I've got athletic trainer Robin Hayes and physical therapist Marlene Hatch with Intermountain Park City Hospital. How's it going today?
Doing well, thank
Great.
You.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, so you're here to tell us about a speaker series going on. One of the last of the three, I believe, in the series going on Tuesday. What can you tell me what it's about?
Yeah, so we are really going to focus on strengthening and prevention tips for the young female athlete, talking about specific exercises they can do early on to help prevent injuries and also boost their performance.
Yeah, any mention?
Yeah, and we're also going to bring in, we typically bring in a future athlete for these events. So this series, we're going to bring in Vita Meyer, who was a Dartmouth collegiate lacrosse player. And she's going to talk to us about how she did strength training all the way through high school and how that really prevented, she feels like really prevented her from having any injuries that would take her out for a season. So we're excited to have her share her story and have people have her there to ask questions. She also is an assistant coach at Park City High School, so it'd be great to have her on our panel that day.
Yeah, and why did you feel the need to do this class in terms of the topic?
Sure, I think we can both add to that, but because as you know, females are not just little males, and so we really want to address the female body specifically and the changes that they may go through and the need for stability and posture and posterior chain strengthening to help these females be successful and prevent injuries, but also to maximize their power and strength, which will enhance their performance. A lot of female athletes drop out of sport for particular reasons, so we want to make sure that they understand the importance of those, and I think Robin can also add different types of training we're going to address in this lecture.
Yeah, so we're going to go through when you can start strength training and that it's, you know, not to be afraid to add weight, and that we want to really be conscious of that girls are in the gym just like their peers are, their boy, our male peers, so that they can definitely increase their power and strength and then prevent injuries, because we are seeing a lot of injuries on the professional level. So if we can prevent that and these girls can get to college or whatever they want to do with their sport, it'll be a great talk.
Yeah, and I'm sure it depends on the sport, but what are kind of those common injuries that you do see?
So with our female athlete, we see definitely more, we call patellofemoral pain or more knee pain. We're seeing a lot more ACLs, which has kind of been the buzzword the last couple of years, especially on the professional soccer side. It's been taking many girls out of their sport, and so those are like two really common things. And Marlene can add to anything else.
Yeah, I think it's just important to understand that in the female athlete, their bodies are shaped a little differently, and as they go through puberty and get their period, things happen to their bodies and they need to pay more attention to their hip strength and their core control to help prevent injuries, maybe more than a male athlete would. And so we really want to make sure that they're not embarrassed to talk about these things, bring them up, and then address them early on so that it's more of a maintenance type of their program and not something they're doing occasionally, but it's a foundation of their program so that they can be successful all the way through into their adult life.
Yeah, and for adult female athletes, is there a general guideline you suggest in terms of balance between like a cardio and strength if you're kind of making a weekly fitness routine? Where do you kind of land in terms of percentages?
Well, the American College of Sports Medicine recommends strength training 2 to 3 days per week. So that's in the gym with weights and, mm-hmm. it's, and not to be afraid of heavy weights. And then just complementing it with your cardio sessions four times a week.
Yeah. Any other future speaker series coming up following the end of this one?
Well, this will wrap up our adolescent female athlete.
Okay.
And we hope in the fall and winter to start addressing the aging female athlete and do the same type of lecture series.
Yeah, and just to touch on the specifics again, this class on Tuesday is at 6 p.m. It is at the Blair Education Center at the hospital, correct? And you two will be speaking along with the athlete you're bringing. Anyone else?
Well, our physician, Dr. Carrie Jaworski, will also be there as well, and she's kind of leading this initiative to get the female athlete program off the ground at Park City Hospital, and so she'll be there to answer questions as well.
Yeah, and what's the details on that new program?
So that's just having a comprehensive female athlete program. So if someone comes into the hospital, they can address nutrition, musculoskeletal issues, medical issues, all under one roof. So we're really trying to make sure that we're meeting their needs all in one place, in addition to the strength and the conditioning and performance side.
Yeah, and just if someone's unable to attend Tuesday, any suggested places they can go just to learn more?
They can surely contact us and we can give them information.
Okay. Anything else you two want to mention?
Just that it's going to be super interactive. Rob and I hope to have the athletes leave with a handful of things they can incorporate into their program right away. We might give them a few little devices to take home with them to use as well. And it's free, so very applicable to not just the female athlete themselves, but also their parents and coaches.
Yeah.
Yeah, we really hope to see a lot of the coaches attend and the athletes themselves so they can have this interactive piece to add.
Awesome.
Programming.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming in to tell us about it. We've been speaking with Robin Hayes and Marlene Hatch. They'll be hosting the speaker series at the Park City Hospital. That's taking place Tuesday, June 11th at 6 p.m. Once again, that's on keeping the young female athlete in the game, strength and conditioning tips for injury prevention and better performance. That's 6 p.m. Tuesday at the Blair Education Center at the Park City Hospital. Thanks so much for coming in again.
Thanks,
Parker.
Thank
you.
Getting back to some news, Park City's popular breakfast and lunch eatery, Five Seeds, is getting a sister restaurant that will serve dinner. KPCW's Christine Weller has details.
Five Seeds at 1600 Snow Creek Drive was opened by Australians Andrew and Tiffany Percy, and it was a quick hit. The restaurant was meant to emulate breakfast spots the couple loved back home, and the restaurant continues to be popular. But the Percys sold Five Seeds to Ian Pope, Price Nickel, and Mark Schreiber in 2023 so they could move back to Australia. Pope is also from Australia and was the general manager of Five Seeds for 4 years before taking it over. Now, Pope and his two partners want to expand the Five Seeds experience into an Aussie-inspired dinner spot called Matilda.
It's the number one thing our solid fan base at Five Seeds asks for. They always ask, when are we opening for dinner?
However, he said the logistics of opening for dinner at Five Seeds just wouldn't work, so the team purchased a space right next door. The name, design, and menu of the new restaurant link back to Pope's Australian heritage. The name Matilda is a reference to the country's pseudo-national anthem, Waltzing Matilda.
We wanted something kind of different than what you see in Park City. Wanted to have something that reminded me of a small wine bar of Sydney and Melbourne, just something a little bit more casual.
The restaurant will have a dining room as well as a lounge area and bar. Pope said the focal point at Matilda will be a large Mara Forney rotating pizza oven in the open kitchen. The menu will be simple. featuring sourdough pizzas and produce-driven share plates. Pope said the idea to feature pizza formed during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I fell in love with sourdough, like a lot of people, during COVID. And then we started being really good friends with the Gosney crew, who have their headquarters in Park City and Salt Lake. They make amazing pizza ovens. And just through that kind of connection, started making a lot of really great sourdough pizzas.
The team then started hosting various pop-ups throughout Park City for charity, and Matilda will be a permanent spot for their pizza creations. Pope said co-owner Nickel loves wine, so the trio are also planning to have a concise and unique wine menu like someone would see in New York, LA, or Sydney. The team wants to branch out from standard wines found at local liquor stores. Despite his Aussie roots and dining theme, Pope said he loves Park City.
We've got a really great customer base. Park City hospitality is now in my blood.
Pope says the trio has finished the design process and is going through permitting right now. Matilda is set to open this fall. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Vail Resorts CEO Kirsten Lynch told investors yesterday the company's net ski season revenue increased 1% compared to last season. Ancillary spending from visitors held strong during the second and third quarter, she said, despite there being fewer visitors.
Which we believe was driven by a combination of unfavorable conditions and broader industry normalization post-COVID following record visitation in the U.S. during the 2022-2023 ski season.
Lift ticket visits declined 17%, but Lynch does not believe that's because of lift ticket prices. You've been listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. Thanks for tuning in.